It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to A Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson.
Hello.
And today we're going to be going across a bunch of different topics, but I'm going to try to keep my head from exploding. So please forgive me as we go on with this.
I've gotten him. Well, you came in riled up.
Well, it's true. It's true. But I'm trying to work my way through this here. But so I see now where I was doing wrong, Paul. So joining us today, Dr. Paul White, professor of social psychology at the University of Utah.
Hello. How are you all doing?
And a friend of our show.
Paul and I are doing great.
He is going to bring some sensibility to the show because, again, I'm already on the edge of the cliff here.
He's not feeling very reasonable today.
I'm not. You know.
Do we want to go first?
I want to say what we decided to do.
We were going to just each bring a couple of topics and maybe spend one segment on each topic. Paul decided to join us, so we're going to let him have an opportunity. And then the last segment, we're going to talk about a group decision. But let's talk about if you don't want to go first, I'll go first. I came to this, subbing on KSL Radio last mm-hmm. Wednesday with Representative Handy, and we started talking about the Medicaid expansion and the lack of Medicaid expansion.
So there's Medicaid expansion that's happening here in Utah.
Yes. There was a proposition that voters approved, which would have covered, I think it's like 70,000. It's anybody under 125% of the poverty, right. The federal poverty level, which is $16,000. I don't know the exact numbers. I'll Google it. But so they came up with a Utah compromise, and it was not approved by the federal government, and it covered some of the people. It covered those under that made less than $12,000 a year. And the federal government said, no, we're not going to approve that, and we're not going to help pay for that, which they have the right to do because the Affordable Care Act actually specifies what you have to do to be eligible for federal dollars in Medicaid expansion. So now there's a special session that's coming up on, I think it's next Monday night, mm-hmm. The day after you're listening to this podcast, unless you hear it later, much later. And I think we're September 30th. Friday the 13th today. That's why you're upset.
Yeah, right, yeah.
In discussing this, I became aware of my own language. And it's something that you and I, when we've interviewed people on healthcare access before, I've been aware of, is that we keep debating access to health insurance rather than access to healthcare. And I will say, as a person who grew up without healthcare and whose family struggled financially at times, that access to health insurance is not access to health care, because if you have insurance, you still might not have enough money to go and have the medical tests or do the things that you need to do.
To get the kind of treatment that you would need.
It depends on the health insurance you have, right?
Because you could have, depending on if your pre-existing conditions back before the Affordable Care Act, you could have high deductibles. So
deductibles probably keeps a lot of people out of
right.
Well, I'll give you an example. So under the Affordable Care Act, most insurance plans are supposed to offer wellness care. There's not supposed to be a copay associated with that, right? But I have to see a specialist for an ongoing continual problem. So I have to pay $25 every time I go. And if they want to see me once a week, I have to pay $25 a week.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody who doesn't have the money, that's too much. Like, you would not get
every
that
time.
Treatment. Yeah,
right.
There are times where I'm like, this is really expensive. I don't know if I should be doing this, but I think it's making me feel better, so I want to keep doing it. The other thing is, if your insurance company decides that something is not medically necessary, right? My dermatologist recommended that I have a little like they consider it like a precancerous thing taken off my face. And our insurance company here at DMBA said, that's cosmetic. And I was like, have you seen my face? That is not cosmetic. And so they didn't pay for it. So that was like $110, you know. Plus I had to pay a specialty copay, $25. So, you know, that's why I want us to shift our conversation. When we discuss, when you're listening to politicians discuss access to health care, most of what they're talking about is access to health insurance. The only thing that's a little different is if you're on, if you have Medicaid or if you're a Medicare recipient, there are some different rules because the government negotiates, and the government's a much better negotiator apparently than all of our private insurance companies. Or most of our,
it's volume.
Yes.
Yeah, it's it is volume, but it's also saying, and when you have volume like Walmart or something, you can say, we're only paying this. So if you want our 10,000 customers,
you got to do this.
You're going to take this fee.
Right.
And so I really feel like if we don't address the cost of what healthcare, you know, the cost of healthcare, and somebody made this other point. Have you guys ever had, we've all had big procedures. You just had one in May. You've probably had them. So my daughter, when she would have her heart, when she had her heart surgery, we got bills from people I didn't recognize. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what they did. You know, it said it associated it with our hospital stay, but I never consented to that. I never saw that person. I don't know what they did. And when I call on it, they say, well, each doctor bills different, separately. So if your anesthesiologist has somebody covering for them and then they have to do something when you're not there and your kid is in the hospital, then you have to pay for that. And there's no negotiating it.
Right.
Cost-wise or whatever.
It's and they don't ask you either.
It is the worst system ever.
Well, let's go to an easy example that most people may know. If you've ever had an x-ray, if your physician has ever told you to go get an x-ray, you'll get a bill from usually your physician, the hospital, and the radiologist, who you may not have ever seen and knew had no clue that they were doing this.
Because
it's not the tech.
Yeah,
it's actually the radiologist who reads
looks
it.
Looks at it. Yeah,
and you don't have any say, any control over that, or how much it's going to be.
So, like for me, I've had health insurance all my life, but I recognize just kind of what Paul said. I've more recently I've gotten bills from people. I'm like, I know I never saw this person,
right?
But somehow they are charging me a substantial amount of money that I have no choice but to pay. And you can't even negotiate. And you can appeal, but oftentimes you lose. And your insurance company, certainly, they just throw their hands up at some point saying, well, this is what we pay no matter what. And you have to be responsible for the rest of that.
It would be nice. I mean, that's one of the things. It would be nice to know what some of these costs could be up front. Because you don't, I mean, and where I had a procedure that was very expensive, it was kind of odd to see the hospital later contacting us saying, well, here's your bill. If you pay X amount by this date, you're good. But if you can't pay X amount, we can go through a payment plan, et cetera. And I thought, wait, so in the X amount was a substantial amount less than the total bill.
So I had this experience when my daughter had her first heart surgery. They sent me a bill that I could not pay, and we have great insurance here, and so we're supposed to pay 10%, right? 10% of $75,000 is
a lot of money. Yeah.
So I was like, "What options do you have for me besides me putting this on a credit card and paying what is it between 12% and 28%, right?" And they said, "Well, if you can find a way to pay this all at once, we'll give you a cash discount."
Yes.
And then we negotiated what that was. Now, let me say, that was not for everything because, like, I kept getting these random doctor bills here and there. The other thing is I have fought with insurance, and all I've won from fighting with insurance, I've never won a battle. It is that I get to pay late fees because my doctor doesn't say, oh, you're fighting with your insurance, I'll wait for you. They just keep adding $10 a month that I don't pay. And if you've ever tried dealing with insurance, it is not a quick and easy process. Right. So for me, when you're listening to these politicians talk about this, or you get the opportunity to ask questions or to do research, look at whether or not what they're offering is access to insurance or access to healthcare, and if any of these options address the skyrocketing costs of healthcare. because that's what I think we really need to address.
So when we come back, I think I may be down off the cliff long enough to get my topic started, and then hopefully you guys will keep me from just blowing up altogether. We have a lot to talk about today, so strap it in and get ready.
We're going on a wild ride.
We're going on a wild ride. You're listening to Voices of Reason.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. And today we are joined by Dr. Paul White, social psychology professor at the University of Utah, who is helping us talk about a number of topics, and he may give me some therapy before this whole thing is out.
I'm not that kind of psychologist.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that. I'll have to go to my actual therapist for that.
You're not like me. You don't practice without a license.
Yes. So Amy wanted to talk about how we discuss health care and the difference between health care and health insurance. And so recently, Hurricane Dorian pretty much decimated the Bahamas. And if you've seen the pictures, and every disaster is monumentally tragic. I mean, I'm not saying one is worse than the other. However, just most recent example, just it's a small, if you've ever been to the Bahamas, I have, it's a small chain of islands, and they're not a lot of people, but they're, you know, it's a beautiful place, but they sit, you know, right in the middle of the water. So it does present some inherent dangers. So they have this awful situation with the hurricane, and many people they lost their homes and they had no place to go. So they tried to seek refuge in America, the closest place to them that had some place for them to potentially go. And the Trump administration, led by the president, by the way, is saying that, and I bring that up because this is out of his mouth, so this is not some minion or some advisor saying this. This is the president actually saying
and
this.
And he's defending it.
And of course he is. Saying that we don't have a place for the Bahamian people to come. And he has denied them access, entrance into the United States, despite the fact that we know what has happened to them and they have no place else to go. Okay.
But what he said is if you have a visa, you can come.
Right.
So if you have and just so you know, the history of the U.S. and Bahamas.
Right.
You don't need a visa if you're staying less than 90 days in the Bahamas, and vice versa. They don't need a visa to come to the U.S.
And this has been going on for years.
This is
going back and forth from the Bahamas to Florida is an easy, simple thing.
Yeah,
right.
We have a very interdependent economy with it, and it's tourists. It's based on tourism.
Absolutely.
So when this happened, most Bahamians said, you know what, let's go to the U.S. We have relatives, we have friends, we have connections, we have support. And we can figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to rebuild, right? And the vast majority of those people see this as a temporary option until they...
Because they want to go back home.
Because right now, some of the cities are still underwater.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really a devastating, if you look at the pictures from space are just really gut-wrenching. So, if you do have options, go. And so people boarded up on a boat, and this is the first time I saw it. Someone tweeted, and I think it was a reporter, people being asked to leave the boat if they didn't have a visa. And no one knew what that was about.
Because they never used one before.
But apparently the ferry captain had been told it's okay if they don't have
come.
A visa.
Yeah. Because we're just dealing, we're responding to a crisis, right? This bad thing happened. We're trying to help these people. We're not worried about, you know, documentation. So then once the people got on the boat, they were told, see, Customs and Border Patrol actually did let them know if they don't have a visa, they can't come in. Some people had visas, but maybe they had a one guy had a two-year-old who didn't have a visa.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they had to, because he comes to the U.S. for work. So they had to leave the boat and stay in, you know.
In the Bahamas, where they have
nothing.
Again,
they don't even have clean water. Right. I mean, the fact is, you don't have water. You're going to try to get your kids somewhere where they can be clean and have food and water.
Going on to this, this happened again. You know, we're talking about S-hole countries, right? This is yet another extension of that doctrine by the president and his administration. I have a number of conservative friends. We people on the civil politics social media platform have suggested to me on many occasions that they don't believe the president is racist. I have never believed that. And I have followed Donald Trump's career in public life since I, as a 54-year-old almost now, since I was like 12. I have known about Donald Trump forever. And I've been a news nerd since before most people here listening to this program. He is not a person of integrity, first of all, but he's a racist guy. This policy speaks to that. The way he has treated folks from, well, I guess, Latin American countries. Certainly, when he started off, was talking about people from Mexico. This is an extension of that. I don't care about how people defend it. I don't, because, I mean, I've stopped listening to that. Because I know what I know. My eyes see it. I am intellectually capable of understanding what it is I'm watching and what's going on. And that, this is, to me, is just the worst case of discrimination and just cold-heartedness and inhumanity that I have seen since Puerto Rico, which we, again, the fact that we're still having that discussion when we have not been able to help them in a way that has been substantial enough to get them going again, you know, back to normal the way they had been previously. I'm literally sick and tired.
You're tired
of people defending this kind of behavior, these kinds of policies. We are better. This country is better than the policies being administered by Donald Trump and his cabinet members, his advisors, all these people. I'm not a religious guy, so I'm only saying what my grandmother used to say: Lord help them. Because
yep. Paul's a religious. What do you think? What are
you
thoughts?
Well, me nuts.
It's okay. There, one of the things that hit me with what's going on with the ferry and the Bohemians was the idea that it was when Mr. Trump came out saying, that this was the policy, they were going to do this. It was the reason why. Part of the reason why he said is you don't know if there's drug dealers and gang members and these violent people who shouldn't be in the Bahamas that are now going to use this to come to the United States. Mm-hmm. That's a similar pattern as what he says about the southern border. It's a similar pattern as what he talked about with Puerto Rico. It seems like it does. It's certain groups, certain areas mm-hmm. that he uses that type of language for. He was just in, and I was going to try to look this up, but I decided not to. He was just in Baltimore, I guess last night or yesterday. And think about what he said about Baltimore compared to, and then when people called him out on it, he started saying some nasty negative things about San Francisco, but it still was not the same language. And
rat infested, and, no right. human would want to live there.
Yes, those
in case
kind of,
you missed
that,
it.
That kind of imagery that he wants to project on certain groups, certain places.
Mm-hmm. And let me just interject on this idea that gang members might be in the Bahamas and use this to come to the U.S. That if Hurricane Dorian had never happened, they could have done just
easily.
That.
Exactly.
Because we've had this longstanding relationship with the Bahamas that people could come here for 90 days or less with no visa. So he's now trying to address a problem that in a crisis that we apparently were unwilling or un,
willing to,
aware of before the crisis.
And did nothing about it.
And did nothing about it. So to me, that is convenient at best, racist, realistically. I find that this is just fatigue with the cruelty. Because for me, the worst thing we're doing is taking little babies from their mothers and fathers and grandparents on the southern border and putting them in jail.
And I can up
you.
I can up
you
that
can up
too.
That.
Yep.
What do you got for me?
If you, I can't remember the exact policy, but it's where there are people who are here as immigrants who are the medical deferments.
Oh yeah.
They just had a hearing on this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where now that policy has been
rescinded
or not rescinded, or we don't know.
It's been rescinded. What they're now debating is if people are already here having medical, and they're in the throes of medical treatment right now.
Will they be
thrown out right. While their medical treatment is
these
not
these are people
yet
who
complete.
Are being treated for
life-threatening
illnesses.
In a
cancer.
In a couple of cases, there are people who were. These are such rare diseases. They were invited to come to the United States because of their disease to be basically
guinea pigs
to be a study.
Medical study, yeah.
Yeah.
And somehow we want to make them leave now.
Because that will make us safer?
Right.
I mean, if the immigration issues, right, that we're having and his immigration policy is aimed at making us safer, you tell me, how does it make us safer to take children from their parents and put them in jail? And warehouse them like you wouldn't warehouse animals. How does it make us safer not to let people who are suffering in a catastrophe, a natural disaster, to come here and try to get clean water and food so they can go back and rebuild their lives?
Right.
How does it make us safer to kick sick people out of this country?
And how does it make us safer to bring people from Russia where they have some of the worst mafiosos in the world?
Because that's what's a lot of the targets are non-white,
and
for people who are local in Utah and can remember this, just think about Hurricane Katrina. It would be to me, it would be the equivalent of the state of Utah saying to the people from New Orleans and that area
that were coming here.
Sorry, no, you're from a place that there is crime, maybe gang members. Gang members, there could be drug people, and we're not going to allow you in our state. I cannot imagine the people of Utah standing for that. But we, as you brought up at the beginning, we seem to be kind of standing for that as a country, as a society, when our leadership is doing that from the federal government.
Let me add one more for you.
Hurry up. Because
okay, I'll be really fast. They're now looking at the citizenship of people who were born through midwives who are of Latin and Hispanic descent, especially the Texas area. So they're reviewing them because they said there's been fraud. And so I'm just saying,
you're not helping me, Amy.
No, but I'm telling you this not to. They're both like rolling their eyes and covering their heads. Let me say, I tell you this to say, we are tired of this. We have compassion. We have cruelty fatigue. You know, you get compassion fatigue from helping so much. We have cruelty fatigue because our country has been so cruel in the last couple of years. And I'm saying, we can't afford this. Those little babies in that prison, those people in the Bahamas, they need us to be diligent and to stay educated and stay active. So when you feel tired, think about what it would be like to try to get your baby clean water in a place that's just been hit by a hurricane and stop feeling sorry for yourself and do something.
Yep. Eyes on the prize.
Right. When we come back, we'll let Paul talk about what his particular topic of the day is. And then at the end, we're going to talk a little bit more about civil dialogue and how we can actually have that continue in a time when divisiveness is just rampant. This is Voices of Reason. We are back with Voices Voices of Reason, and I'm hopefully off that cliff. This is Jason Lee, along with my broadcast partner, Amy Donaldson, and we're here with Dr. Paul White. He is a social psychology professor at the University of Utah. And Amy and I had the first couple of segments, and though we should have let our guests go first, probably.
No.
Paul, what is it you want to talk about?
Well, kind of dovetailing on the last segment from what you were talking about, what Amy brought up, thinking about fatigue and thinking about how news coverage should be of not just, you know, it's easy thinking Trump administration, but politicians in general. The debate last night, you know, people are wanting to look for the, you know, it's that horse race as how the news media has been covering a lot of this.
Which moment did they have, right? Like, yeah, which moment?
How did they, who won? Who, you know, instead of what are the issues that are being discussed? And I was, it is that kind of, in particular, I'll give this example of where we were, I brought up last time of, with the medical deferment program, there is a part of me that wonders if some of this isn't a shiny key. It's horrific. And even the, you know, taking children away from their families, some of these other things may be being done because people say the cruelty is the point, that then the news and everybody goes after that. It's, that's why I think of it as shiny key and not thinking about all these other issues that are going on. But it also could be a door in the face type of technique, and or foot in the door, either way. So door in the face is you say something really bad, or you make a big request. You know you're going to get rejected, so you make the real request you want. So instead of, well, okay, yes, we won't kick out the medical children, but what about these other people? Can we kick them out? And that's okay, kind of idea. And either way, it's kind of, to right. me, bad. Mm-hmm. And so how, as news people, how do you, if this was a utopia and you could cover politicians the way you want to, how would you handle these kind of situations?
Well, like for me, you're supposed to not have an opinion, right? So factually based, you literally just cover what it is they're doing and allow the actions to speak for themselves. So in that way, I mean, that's the way I've always learned. And to be honest with you, I don't know another way, because I feel like if you have an agenda, then you've kind of missed the point of being an impartial journalist. I don't know if, Amy, you might have a different perspective.
Yeah, so I don't follow the president on Twitter for the very reason that I don't want to get distracted by the little stuff. And so I'll give you an example. When Hurricane Dorian was on its way towards the Bahamas, I think it was actually maybe the day before I hit the Bahamas, they were talking about the path it might take afterwards. Was it going to hit Florida? Was it going to go, you know, up the coast? Was it going to miss the U.S.? There was this discussion. And the president tweeted about it was going to hit Alabama and it was going to be worse than expected, which everybody jumped on and some people ridiculed him, but then, because that's what happens on Twitter. If you are not on there, don't get on. And then the Alabama emergency management people tweeted out, and because they were getting calls, and they said, you know, it's not going to hit. No projection has it hitting Alabama. It turns out the president was using a projection that was a couple of days old, where it was headed in a direction that would have gone towards Alabama, although nobody thought it would actually. The hurricane itself would hit Alabama, mm-hmm. maybe winds or rains or whatever. Right. But it had changed course, which storms do. And so 2 days later, it was on a vastly different track and it wasn't going to impact Alabama at all. But then there became this debate about, you know, did he do it? Did they exaggerate it? Did he write on this map with a Sharpie? And he's being dishonest. And, you know, and I had a sister living in South Carolina, and I am desperate for information about what's happening mm-hmm. with my sister, and I have friends in Florida, and I was so frustrated that I couldn't easily find up-to-the-minute information about where that hurricane was going and what kind of danger my sister and my family and friends were in, because all I could see was this debate about did he or didn't he, and it was clear to me that he screwed up and whatever, and people wanted to defend it, and, you know, and now we find out that NOAA officials yep. got threatened and, you know, yeah, like there's yeah. all these things. So for me, here's my problem with what Donald Trump does. He sucks up all the room in the air, whether you think it's a legitimate news story or not, whether the reactions are in proportion to what he did or not. It matters because, and people keep talking about how it's just Twitter. When the president tweets something, it impacts world economic markets. It impact. He's tweeted out policy decisions like transgender people not being able to serve in the military openly anymore. He's tweeted these things out. He's tweeted out policy changes. He fired the national security advisor by Twitter on Twitter. All right. Yep. So, yeah, the tweets matter. So we have to have a way to cover them and keep them sort of in the room while we also do this other stuff. So to me, there's no more shiny keys. I believed that at the beginning of this presidency because I believed in normal things. We've ruined all our normal things. So now our political system is deeply, deeply broken, in my opinion, and our media is deeply, deeply broken. We keep going off on these tangents and having these discussions and debates as the primary thing, when what we should do is, sure, keep on him about drawing on the map and threatening NOAA officials and all that stuff. Stay on that. That's fine. But really make sure that every time you're discussing that, that you're also focusing on the wider, bigger issues, because we have to be able to multitask and we have to be able to say, this weirdness is happening. This is what normal is. This is weird. This is normal.
Well, to go away from Trump, I'll talk. I mean, you had the Democratic debate last night, and I've not watched it yet. I've got it recorded, and I'll probably watch it twice because, I'm news junkie kind of. Yeah.
News nerd.
It's the punishment. I've heard a couple of things already. One was about Biden talking about records, but the other one was Julian Castro saying something about, you don't remember what you said 2 minutes ago. You don't, and it
Which,
turns
by the way,
and it
Julian,
turns out,
yeah,
he it turns out he was wrong.
Correct.
Yes,
that
Biden
was,
didn't say that.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Biden was correct in saying I did not say that.
Yeah,
but that's how I mean and the news coverage I've seen already is. Who won, who lost, who was up, who was down, instead of what did they actually discuss?
Right. And I would say what I say to everyone else, you can find good coverage of this. NPR had a really great roundup of issues, what issues were discussed. They had a quote and a comment or a policy statement from every candidate, right? So you can find this, but you're most likely going to have to read it. And you're going to have to do some work, because if you're following on Twitter or you're looking on your Facebook feed, what rises to the top of social media is this weird, quirky, controversial.
It's headlines, but
headlines, because that indicates like some kind of standard media criteria.
Headlines to me is just the very
sound bites.
Sound bites.
Really sound
and so
bites.
The headline would be like Castro questions Biden's memory. Well, the truth is, you have to dig into that.
Yeah.
And so we as consumers, as news consumers, Paul, when you're asking like how do we cover this, part of the job of the consumer is to, maybe we don't have to watch it twice like you and I might do it, but the idea is to find out the truth by looking more thoroughly rather than just taking the short little soundbite
because one of the things I cop to watching, I watch almost every weeknight, we watch Rachel Maddow. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she has been doing almost from the get-go with this administration, and I wish she would point it toward other politicians as well, is watch what they do, not what they say, because they say a lot of things, mm-hmm. but it's what is it they're actually doing? What's the policy that if they're putting in place and the impact that it's having on people?
Yeah,
that's what we should be focused on.
But let me add, don't conflate commentary and debate amongst journalists and opinion writers and Twitter people with actual news coverage. Right. If you look at your newspaper, if you look at the actual news reporter coverage, I think you have a different experience than commentary.
Well, and I can say this quickly. One of the things that I know a lot of people who lean like I do and in other ways will fuss about Fox News and say Fox News is fake. Fox News is fake. I would like people to know what are they talking about when they say Fox News is fake? What are they talking about when they say CNN is not real or MSNBC? A lot of times it's the opinion shows, the column shows. That's what they're talking about, the early morning, the evening, not the actual news coverage.
Right. And that is very true. And we have to be able to discern those different things. When we come back for the last segment, we're going to talk a bit about what civil dialogue has become, what we hope to have developed with this show, and where we're still fighting some of those the battles of making people who have divergent views at least be able to hear the other person. You're listening to Voices of Reason. Back with Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. And today our guest is Dr. Paul White, a social psychology professor at the University of Utah. And Paul's a guest of our show many times, and he's hopefully bringing some Voices of Reason. And
he's the reasonable one today.
Today, because Jason over here is trying not to
Jason's depressed and angry, and I've drawn so many lines in the sand, I don't even know where I am anymore.
See, and I've got students who are emailing me and asking me questions from lectures on video that clearly they didn't watch the video.
Well, there you go.
That's how I feel about people who criticize stories they don't read.
Exactly. You don't even know what the information is.
So I've taken to on that point, if you're on Facebook and that happens and you read the articles, then just take the quote from the article and respond with that quote. That's been my new thing now.
And don't just read the headline. So, Amy D.
All right, I'm going to take it away.
Yes, please.
So, we promote civil dialogue. And what Jason and I have, we're taking a cue from Jason's mom, a lesson from Jason's life, that you have two ears and one mouth for a reason. That means you should be listening twice as much as you're talking. Very difficult thing for me, not so hard for Jason. But so I love that. That's kind of been our guiding principle that, you know, we're not trying to persuade people with what we say. We're trying to understand one another, where we're coming from, why we believe what we believe, what's bothering us, and how we might better work together on finding solutions. So that to me is what civil dialogue means. And I feel like lately civil dialogue is being used as this weapon to keep people quiet who have legitimate grievances that should be heard in the public sphere. So I'll give you an example, LGBTQ issues. I hear all the time people saying, especially with transgender people, why are they pushing so hard? Why do they want to be out in front? Why are they so flamboyant? Why are they doing things the way they're doing them? Because if they want people to get on board and help them and be sympathetic to them, then they need to be more. What they're saying, I'm going to translate for you, is we need them to be more palatable.
To us.
Yes, to me. To me. And I am not, you know, I know nothing about transgender people. I don't know a single one, but I want them to be, I want them to do what I want them to do, not what they need to do for their lives, right? So the reason that they're stepping out or they're complaining or they have an issue that they're wanting to be addressed in the public domain is because it addresses their very existence. It addresses their ability to live a life that we take for granted. Get married, go to a public restroom, serve in military, have a job, not be fired from a job because of who you are, who you love. These are just basic things that allow you to go live your life. They don't have anything to do with all the extras. And so when they speak out in a way that you find uncomfortable, I would suggest asking yourself, I've had this experience. Why am I uncomfortable with this? Like, I will say that Colin Kaepernick's kneeling during the national anthem. I grew up in a very patriotic home. You know my dad, and he's a Vietnam veteran. I would never kneel during the. I get mad when people talk during the national anthem, and so it made me extremely uncomfortable. Instead of saying he doesn't have the right to do that, which I believe he does, I said, "Why is he doing that? What's behind that? What is he trying to say that I need to hear that's so painful in his life that he's trying to make us all uncomfortable?"
And to that, I would suggest that when we have civil dialogue, it's not to – my point always has been to hear the other person. Just because you say something – and this is into civility. Just because you say something calmly, you can still be an a-hole. All right? I use Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin as my example for that. And the reason is because Matt Bevin, he talks the same way all the time. He's trying to
never raises his voice.
He never raises his voice. He looks like he's being polite, but then he's always crass and judgmental and bigoted. So I don't mind that you do that, but when just because it's just the whole passive aggressive thing that they do. Utah's famous for that, right? You can still be a jerk when you're being calm to somebody. You don't have to look like Sean Hannity, like your head's going to explode. Right. But if you do, people get that a little easier. But if you kind of dial it down, you could still be just as dismissive and and just as wrong and rude as you could possibly be.
Yeah.
So I don't. I want a dialogue that is truly civil, in that you are trying to hear another person's point of view so that you can be enlightened by it, even if it does not change your opinion necessarily.
Well, I have, as a Kentuckian, I have to say, Governor Bevin is not from Kentucky. He moved there. But and bless your heart, Jason. And see, that's
I'm
that's,
telling you, man.
But that's right there is one of those examples.
That's right.
Bless your heart.
That's right.
You know, oh, the Lord's gonna mm-hmm. the Lord's gonna put their hand on him. What I was looking for is something I use in one of my classes, my intergroup relations class, and this is from 1998, and it was an article. This is after just after Matthew Shepard.
Matthew Shepard was a gay young man who was brutally beaten in, was it Wyoming?
Laramie,
Wyoming.
Left to die.
Left to die, hanging on a post. And a local person, Gail Ruzicka, was asked, this is an...
A local Utah.
Yeah. If people want to find the citation, I can give you the citation. One of the things, she was interviewed by this reporter and asked, you know, saying that... Her rhetoric, and again, this is 1998, and others like her, thinking LGBT mm-hmm. issues, that maybe that rhetoric was helped do this. And she says, quote, come on, people hurt homosexuals because I say homosexuality is immoral? That's crazy. In the same article, later on, she talked about another violent action was saying how gay and lesbian people are part of her friends, but she goes, I'm not judging them personally. Our only concern is when they take their immoral sexual practices to the arena of public policy. If they would keep quiet, no one would bother them, unquote. And again, not, I know she's probably said it at the time and probably would say it now, not realizing that those two things are very
incongruous.
Yeah.
And I think
and Gail Ruzicka, just real quickly, she is the head of what's called the Eagle Forum,
yeah.
which is this ultra conservative group who has a lot of influence in our state legislature, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. Although I think it's lessening. I think that
it's still
too
much to me.
Yeah. Well,
she's
I think
not
any,
elected to anything.
Well, I think any is because I like any lobbyist. I think it should be less.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Always, but I think. I guess my plea with people is when they have these discussions, we always encourage you to talk to people who believe something different or who think differently than you or have a different opinion than you. And hopefully you are different political parties. I've tried to remain engaged with my friends who believe and think differently than me. It is difficult for me sometimes because I feel like we're still trying to persuade each other. Mm-hmm. And I have to always ask myself, like, what's my purpose here? And what do I want to accomplish with this conversation? And really, I've learned a lot from people who think differently than me. And I understand where they're coming from in a way that makes me understand why someone would vote for Trump, who is a nice, kind, loving person in their real life, right? Because to me, he's just a bully. And why would you ever support somebody who's mean and hateful like that, regardless of who he's being mean and hateful to? But I think that I want people to understand that when something makes them uncomfortable, that there might be a good reason for that. And that they need to stop and say...
Self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just stop and say, why does this person feel so distressed by this situation that they are acting in a way that normally we would not... they're not marching down the street. They're not sitting at a lunch counter getting food poured over their head, right? Why are they doing that? What is the problem? What do I need to look at in society? And I'll tell you what, I had one of those moments when I stood in line with my friends on December 20th when they were trying to get married before... they thought a judge mm-hmm. would issue an injunction that would not allow them to do so. And I just remember thinking, I've always taken for granted that you can walk in here and get a license and marry the person you love on the day you want, the way you want, all of that stuff. It's not true. You and your wife in 1968 mm-hmm. would not have been
right.
able to get married. I think that we have to be more compassionate, I guess, and stop using civility as a club. If you practice civility, then shut up and listen. That's my mantra for myself.
That's all I have to say on that subject.
Well, I've got a book recommendation
okay,
for people,
good.
Though. And it's not, it may help with civility in some ways. Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt, it's Eberhardt.
Yeah. I know it has a T.
Her book,
she was just
Biased.
Here.
Yes, I got. and I got to reconnect with her. And she did a great talk at Westminster a couple of nights ago. But the book really does a nice illustration of talking about biases that we can have and getting to see them in ourselves and not and just where they come from. And it's research based, which is which as a social psychologist, that's what I would love.
The book is called Biased.
Biased. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Dr. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
A plea, a book recommendation, and Jason survived.
You know, but barely. And we all know that I was this close to almost not surviving, so that's what's really bothering me.
You got to keep your blood pressure down there, my friend.
You're totally right about that. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. And listen, join us again for the next episode of the Voices of Reason, Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. If you have any comments about our show, please contact us via email at vorameed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at @AdOnSports and @JasonLee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORPodcast. You can find episodes of our podcast any place where you can find interesting podcast content, including Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts. And be sure to review our show as well. We love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason.
Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now, too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.